We are so lucky to have a diversity of wildlife here in the state, a very rich diversity. Some of them are here year-round, some leave for the winter, and some only show up when it's cold and snowy outside. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. There's something to watch for and marvel in every season, isn't there? And although it might surprise you, winter is no exception. David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension and associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. One of our guests today. David, great to see you back.
Thank you, Larry. I'd like to be calling in from Texas or Florida, but I'm here with you today.
All right. Well, Jamie Knack is with us as well. Jamie, wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Jamie, always great to see you.
Great. It's nice to be back, and happy holidays to you,
happy
Larry.
Happy holidays to you as well, and happy holidays to all of our listeners and to the wildlife out there, too. And I hope you have a question or a comment. Maybe you've had a great experience, wildlife experience to share. Noticed anything lately? What are they up to? Have you seen any of those snowy owls? Well, there's a few there floating around here, flying around here in Wisconsin, believe it or not. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. If you've got some good wildlife shots, we'd love to see those as well on the Facebook page. So you can do that too. Last year, the Upper Midwest was treated to, we had a great influx of snowy owls. And looks like we've got a few already, haven't we?
Yeah, it looks like there's quite a few down. And I wouldn't say record numbers, but there are, I think, last count were roughly about 60 snowy owls in our area. And certainly they come down from Canada in the wintertime. They're kind of found the food source down here when the snow gets a little too heavy up in Canada. And it's a joy to see them. They're one of the owl species that we have in the state of Wisconsin. They're called snowy owls because they're almost all white. They've got some black mottling on them in various parts of their body. But when you see them and you see this all-white owl, it's very hard to make a mistake with the identification of that species. And they're in and around the Madison area pretty commonly, as well as throughout the other parts of the state. But I remember a couple of years ago when they were doing some construction of the Memorial Union here on campus, that somebody had posted a picture of a snowy owl sitting on top of one of the cranes that was helping to build the union.
Yeah.
That is amazing that they made it to Madison.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. And actually, listeners, if you're interested in an opportunity to try to see a snowy owl in the state, you can go to eBird website and look at a map or an aerial photo of where various sightings have come in. So you can click on them and look at the date that they were observed, and it'll have a little location. But places to look for are open grassland habitat, like Horicon Marsh would be a typical landscape that we'd be looking at. And then also along the coastal shores, or even along jetties or along the piers, they'll perch and look for food. So there's a couple different reasons why they may be coming this far south, and I think the researchers, biologists, are still trying to sort that out. But it's either because there was a very good lemming year, which is their prey item in Canada. It was a very good year, and reproduction was good, and now there are a lot of juvenile birds looking for their own territories, and they push out and move further south. Or it was not a very good lemming year, and prey is scarce, and they end up moving south. And I think that right now the current line of thinking is that it's the former rather than the later. So good news for snowy owls.
Yeah, so we also get some other owls that push into our area occasionally. I think that last year the one really interesting and neat story for a lot of people was the great gray owl that came so far south into Madison and Malston and some other areas into southern Wisconsin. And that was a real rarity for something like that. But, you know, you go up into northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, areas like that, occasionally you'll get these what's called eruptions of great gray owls, hawk owls, snowy owls, and things like that. And it's a real treat to see them.
Very, very cool. Judith got a great photo last year of the great gray owl.
Oh, and wonderful.
It was, yeah, we posted it up on my Facebook page. It was really pretty. And I have, you know, the snowy owls, I have one of the great wildlife photographers is Tom Mangelson. And I have one of his shots of a snowy owl on a barn roof against an old barn roof against a blue sky. It is just absolutely beautiful. And I have a wood carved snowy owl from Bob Googie, who was the world champion, actually, a wood carver, bird carver. But I've never seen one in person. I've got that snowy owl on my mantle, and
yeah, you'll have to get on eBird and take a little trip this weekend and see if you can't find one.
That would be
one.
A lot of fun. I mean, yeah, I'm going to have to go to eBird.
We'll take you out, and we're going to make it a mission to find a snowy owl for you now, Larry. So, eBird's one, and the other place I'll point the listeners is Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. They've got rare bird alerts on their website. So if you just Google Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and then on the left-hand menu, you'll see rare bird alerts. And that's not only a great place to see things like snowy owls, but other birds that are not so common in our area that come into our area. It's a great website to kind of bookmark, and especially if you're a birder, look for some of the unusual birds.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Well, Fred in Wisconsin Rapids has a question, so let's go to Fred. Hi, Fred. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks, guys. I'm kind of, in my old age, a tender-hearted hunter, so I'm fortunate to own some land. But I'm always glad when the gun season is over that the animals, especially on my land, are protected.
Uh-huh.
We get the bitter cold after the deer have been ran and whatever. And my question is, with these bitter nights, I always wonder, where are the deer bedded down? And my question is do the does that still have fawns, do they huddle together? Under evergreens or whatever, or does the buck stay all by itself, I imagine. But I'm just wondering, in these bitter colds where it's 24 below or 20, how does these animals like the deer, especially the does with the fawns, survive?
Mm-hmm. Good question.
Hey, great question, Fred. And I think when we do hit those extreme temperatures, we do start to kind of worry about wildlife. But we have to remember that they've been adapted and kind of built to survive the various habitats that we find them in. But the deer itself has a few adaptations to help it survive the winter. It puts on a winter coat, so a heavier coat. It also has hollow hair that holds traps air that acts as insulation. And then as far as where they would bed or where they would seek shelter, they often yard up if we have a lot of snow and extreme cold. They will go to areas that we refer to as deer yards, where they're going to spend time, especially during the middle of the day, where they're getting protected. So a lot of times those are cedar swamps or places where you have significant amount of conifers, or it could be in shelter belts if you're in the southern farm country. But they're going to lay low somewhere where they still have a good vantage point in terms of predators, but where they can get out of the wind is probably more important than as far as like being on the sunny side of a hill or something like that. Being on the downwind side or not being in the wind would be more important. So they have physical adaptations to help survive the winter. And as far as the question about the does and their fawns, when they yard, it can be a mixed group for sure. But also those fawns some of them will have split. The doe will have kicked them out, especially during the rutting time period. She often will kick her fawns out so that she can be bred by another buck during that time. So she may or may not be with fawns, and they may herd together as a whole group within a yarding area.
Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely right. You do think about we're in our nice warm homes and beds at night, and it's just howling cold outside. And as Jamie correctly pointed out, all these animals are adapted to live in this climate, and so they either have thick coats or feathers or some animals are hibernating right now. They choose to sleep through the winter, such as the bears or the bats or some of the other mammals. And then certainly some animals leave our state, and as you pointed out in the introduction, Larry, they go south where it's warm, and there's perils to that as well. So although it seems pretty nice to go south, there's quite a high mortality sometimes in some species that are migratory, because they're crossing so many areas that they're not familiar with, and sometimes their wintering grounds are not as good a habitat as the summering grounds and things like that. And so certainly some of the species that stay up here, too, that they don't all survive through the winter, and that's just part of the way to regulate wildlife populations. And we want that, because otherwise they're going to be overrun, and there's going to be more animals in the landscape than the landscape can hold. And then alternatively, when we talk about the cold, because right now it's pretty dang cold out there, but animals have as much trouble sometimes in the hot weather as they do in the very cold weather, because they can overheat. And so they've got to get rid of that internal heat as much as they're trying to hold their heat in the winter. And so those hot weather days can be as harmful to some wildlife as the cold weather days can be.
Fred, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. We would certainly love to hear from you. You've got some great holiday. Before we go back to the phones here, I know you guys have some great holiday gift ideas for the outdoor lovers on our list, and maybe we can talk. You want to talk about a few of them? We can kind of sprinkle this through the course of the
program. Yeah, that sounds good. There's tons of questions. And if you're a procrastinator like David and you haven't started shopping yet, this might be useful to you. But if you have a person who enjoys the natural world, enjoys Wisconsin's parks and outdoors, there's a few things kind of related to enjoying the state parks. So one, you could purchase a state park pass, which is an annual pass. And I forget what those are, if they're around $25 or so, something in that ballpark.
They're not a bank breaker, that's for sure.
Right, right. They're definitely worth it. So that would be a gift idea. Also, a subscription to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources magazine, or even to Wisconsin Outdoor News. And that's more of the consumptive user base for wildlife. But if those are, you know, some of the issues we talk about on the radio and just kind of what's going on in terms of Wisconsin's natural resources, those two would be excellent subscriptions to consider.
You know, another one for those Natural Resource Magazine and the Outdoor News is kind of geared toward, I think, the more adult-type person, but certainly kids, especially the Natural Resource Magazine, that's a pretty glossy, colorful publication.
And
kids
publication,
would certainly find some use in that. But, you know, another one is Ranger Rick Magazine. I kind of grew up in Ranger Rick Magazine.
Yeah, I started my daughter in that one this year. She loves getting her own mail.
So that's the National Wildlife Federation. That might be something that you'd want to get a subscription for a child or a grandchild.
That runs $15. Like I said, I just did that with our daughter, and just seeing her name on the address label, ooh, the kids really like that. They've got a magazine to add to the magazine rack.
those are all great. And we've got some more ideas, and we'll sprinkle these out through the program as we go along here. And maybe you've got an idea of your own as you're listening in, and you want to share that about a great gift for the wildlife lover, the outdoors lover. We'd love to hear about it. Jackie in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi, appreciate your call.
Hi, Larry. I'm vindicated. Quite a while. That's just a comment I have. I said there was a snowy owl on my fence holding a rat. That was over a month ago. And now I'm vindicated. They are coming down here. I sent a letter to Larry about it. But anyhow, my question is, I tried to explain it to somebody, and I didn't know how. How can birds sit on those freezing cold fences? Anything metal. I know there's an explanation about their legs or whatever, but I can't explain it.
Thanks, Jackie.
Jackie, I'm not sure you're vindicated. I think the snowy owls just showed up in Milwaukee this morning, so you may have misidentified that bird. No, I'm giving you a hard time, Jackie. They've been here for a while, and you are vindicated. You are absolutely right in your identification, I'm sure. So how can birds stand on cold metal fences and roofs and things like that? There are a variety of ways, but one of the things is birds do not have many nerve endings in their feet and in their legs. And so without those nerve endings, they don't feel that cold. And they also have the ability, some birds have the ability to what's called shunt off the blood. So if they're standing, for example, if geese, for example, are standing on ice, that they will not send blood down their leg so much because they don't have any feather coverings on their leg. And so as the warm blood goes through that very thin, skinny leg, that they lose a lot of heat. And then it also, that blood, as it comes back to the body, is cold, and it causes them to have to reheat that blood and causes them to lose energy. So a lot of times they'll shunt off the blood, and they won't actually send it down to the leg because they don't want to lose that cold. And they also don't have a lot of tissue in their leg and in their feet like we do in our human legs and feet, and so they don't have to keep that tissue warm and worry about frostbite.
There you go. Thank you, Jackie. Appreciate the call. We are talking today about wildlife here in the state of Wisconsin and beyond with David Drake and Jamie Knack from the University of Wisconsin Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and University of Wisconsin Extension. Join in with your questions or comments, or maybe you've got a story to share at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. Especially love to see some wildlife photos on the Larry Mueller Show. That's the name of the Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guests for today, David Drake and Jamie Knack. Always fun to have them along. We always have a great time when they stop by to talk about wildlife. A couple of things I wanted to mention. You know, people always often ask about Scott Craven. And Scott, of course, a colleague of yours in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And I announced that he was having some heart surgery a couple weeks back. Things have turned out pretty well.
Yeah, Scott's doing really great. He had open heart surgery on December 3rd to replace a valve and was in the hospital for about a week and is now at home recuperating. Probably not as fast as he would like to, but he's making good progress. And we look forward to seeing him up and on his feet. And he's looking forward to spending some holiday time with his family. So
yeah,
he's doing very well.
Yeah, it's a great to know. And hopefully he'll be back the first Wednesday of next month and we'll be able to have him on and talk some more about wildlife. Looking forward to that. You guys often come up with just little ideas of ways to have fun on the show with sounds and photos and whatnot. And today we've got a sound that, just for fun, have people try and identify what animal makes this sound. And it's just something, as people call in, they can say, well, I think it's this or that. And
we can give them one hint. It's a Wisconsin animal. So there's only about 525 to pick from. So
yeah, and this is just for bragging rights.
Yeah, this is for bragging rights here. So let's listen. You know, that sounds like Scott Craven humming a Christmas carol.
Yeah, so Scott, if you're listening, call in and hum a few bars for us.
No, that is an animal, a Wisconsin animal, and so we'll ask people if they know. If you don't know, no big deal. We'll find somebody. We'll find somebody who knows. I'll bet anything. What about Al? Al in Land O'Lakes. You know what that animal was?
Yes, I do.
Oh,
it's a chipmunk.
Oh, close, but no cigar.
But really, good guess.
I was kidding, but.
Oh, all right. Well, you weren't close in size. This animal is bigger than a chipmunk. But you've got something on snowy owls, haven't you?
Yep. Interesting raptor. Very interesting. In the 70s, I lived between Iola and Scandinavia, and I was driving down the road, and right in front of my car, two snowy owls. One of them had a rabbit in its talons. And they're flying in formation like little Jap Zeros, you know. And after that, we had a discussion about the bird. And in the discussion, it was said by a friend of mine that they actually will hunt in packs, and they're capable of bringing down larger game. And I was wondering if you ever heard that or there was any validity to that.
Well, Al, from my experiences, owls are typically solitary hunters. The one thought I would have is that the fact that you're seeing two animals, and what time of year was this?
We lost.
Okay. So potentially, depending on the time of year, the fact that there were two birds together could have been a breeding pair, and they may hunt together or, you know, be in close proximity. So they may not have actually hunted that rabbit together in cooperation. You know, one was, you know, hunted the rabbit and the other was in the vicinity because they were a breeding pair. But typically the raptors do not hunt as a pack.
Chris in Adams County, it's your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I have by the time we're done with this, Larry, you're going to be so jealous of everybody that's going to be wreathing. I was living in between Middleton and Wanakee, And there were people standing on the corner of the intersection with a huge telescope. And so at some point, I was compelled to just stop and say, okay, you're either from the FBI or you're birders, because one of those two things has to be true. And so they said, we're birders. And I said, what are you looking at? The snowy owls sit on top of the white silos on farms because they're camouflaged and the prey cannot see them up there. And so I got to take a look through the telescope at the thing. And I want to just recommend a book to you. There is a book on camouflage by a former professor of mine named Roy Behrens, and you should read it because it's really interesting. It's about how the Army took camouflage from wild animals and camouflage boats in the Army.
Anyway. Oh, is Roy Behrens?
Roy Behrens. I think it's Behrens. It's a book on camouflage in wildlife.
Wow.
It's an obscure thing that now you are aware of.
Well, Chris, thank you. Yes. And you lucky devil, you got to see. Oh, man.
Larry, we're going to take you out, Larry, and find a snowy owl.
As big as you are.
Well, I'm going to have to get out. Boy, I'm telling you. Well, thank you so much. That's a cool. And Roy Behrens, Behrens, I think.
You know, I think, I know for a fact the military looks at a lot of different things in the natural resource world that they then adapt for their own purposes. And certainly the camouflage is one of those. They look at dragonflies because the dragonflies use those four wings and can move in all directions. And so they're trying to mimic that for weaponry and things like that. So they the military is very adept at taking things from the natural world and making them their own.
And Chris, are you still there?
Yeah.
Well, can you name this sound?
No. The owl was too far away to make that sound, so it's not the owl.
It's not the owl. No, you're right about that. All right. Thanks, Chris.
We have not stumped anybody since Jamie and I have been on the show with you with one of our quiz questions, so it would be great today if we could skunk somebody on this. And no, it's not a skunk.
All right. Well, let's see. Let's go to Dan in Quincy, Wisconsin. Dan, hi.
Hello there. I'm fortunate enough to live right on the Wisconsin River. I rent a house, and I just absolutely love it. And last Saturday, I was watching the river, and about 4 to 5 ducks come cruising down, floating down. I look out again, and then they're gone. I'm curious where they went, and then all of a sudden they popped up again. Now, not knowing... Would they be loons? Would loons still be around this time of year?
Dan, I have not heard of any spottings of loons around recently, but certainly loons will come through here in the spring and the fall, and they will occasionally raft up or come in groups, and we'll see them mm-hmm. in some of the lakes around here in Madison occasionally. I've not heard of loon sightings, but what you very well may have seen out there, depending on the size, is there's some diving ducks around, common golden eyes, buffleheads, some mergansers, and things like that. And mergansers can look a little bit like a loon because they sit low in the water with their body, and they kind of have a longer, thin bill like a loon does. So it may have been a merganser that you were looking at.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
But certainly there are ducks around, and then, you know, obviously we divide ducks into categories a couple different ways, but one is a dabbling duck versus a diving duck. And diving ducks, obviously, as it sounds, are the ones that go under the water and dive for fish and mm-hmm. plant material and things like that. And dabbling ducks are like the mallards that just they can't actually dive under the water, but they just stick their behind up in the air and put their head down.
Oh, these were definitely going down, and then they would pop up maybe 15, 20 feet upstream. So
yeah, I would if you have a bird book or go online to one of those search images images and either type in golden eye, common golden eye, bufflehead, or common merganser possibly.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And on Facebook, we've gotten some great photos on Facebook. Joan sent one of a nice one of a long-eared owl. That looked like a long-eared owl.
Yeah. I think it is. Yep.
And then Ryan said he's tracking snowy owl sightings, and we're up to nearly 100 individuals now. This is on Wisconsin eBird. That's more than double last year, he says, but not quite as high as the big eruption of 2 years ago. Some will stay the winter, so folks have plenty of time to find one. Report all sightings to eBird.org. And so we've got that, actually have that link on my Facebook page.
Yeah, Ryan Brady works within the Department of Natural Resources. And actually, if you're really interested in the owl eruption and the winter finch reports and just winter birding in general, they held a online chat yesterday that you can go back to the Department of Natural Resources website and go through the archives and track that. So if you're interested in the birding, lots of great tips and websites and links to take a look at. So you might be interested in that archive of that chat yesterday.
That would be cool. Linda sent us a photo of a partial albino Canada goose. Saw this spring in Jefferson County in the town of Sumner in a flooded farm field.
And that picture could be, well, an albino animal is all white, and for it to be a true albino, it has to have pink eyes and pink nose. So then you get into variations of albinism, and one is leucistic, and one is piebald. And piebald typically refers more to mammals, but that looks like perhaps a leucistic Canada goose, which means that it's a partially white or off-colored animal. And so it could certainly be that. And take a look at Larry's Facebook page.
Yeah, just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you'll see those photos. It's some really nice ones. And we'll probably get, not probably, I'm sure we'll get some more as the show moves along. Let's go to Carol in Oak Creek next. Carol, hi.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about a fox. I've lived in Oak Creek for over 20 years and occasionally see foxes. And it's no big deal. They're very shy and they normally run away from you. But a couple of days ago, I encountered a fox after dark. And so I turned to walk the other way and I looked back and the fox started chasing me and my dog. It chased us all the way home. And I looked on the internet and learned that if they're rabid, they'll give chase. So I reported it to the city, but they're not going to do anything about it. And I was just, you know, if it was a little kid encountering this fox, it would be, you know, not a good thing.
Right.
So I was wondering why the fox would chase me, and, you know, do I have a reason to be very concerned about this?
You know, Carol, that's an interesting question, and I've gotten quite a few both phone calls and emails about behavior like this from fox. And one of the things that's happening right now with the fox population, and it's not just this year, but it's been occurring over time here, is that the fox population is adapting very well to what we call human-built or human-dominated landscapes, so urban, suburban-type areas. And the behavior that you experience for that fox does not necessarily mean that it was rabid, but most likely what's happening is that fox is habituating to people, so it's getting used to people. And once animals lose their fear of humans, they then have no reason not to continue to encounter humans and get closer and closer and closer, despite you having a dog. So that's most likely what happened. And if that occurs again, what you should do is turn around and face the fox and make loud noises and make yourself look very, very large. And perhaps if you've got some snowballs or rocks or something, throw it at the fox. But you want to scare that fox away, and that's what's happening. With the fox.
I tried to scare the fox away, but he was not impressed.
Was not impressed, yeah. Well, and so what we think is going on with some of the especially these urbanized fox populations, is that fox are a canid species, so they're in the dog family. We also have a growing coyote population in the state of Wisconsin, and coyotes will eat fox if they get the opportunity to do so. So what we think is happening, and we're going to actually, another faculty member and I are going to start looking at this here on campus this next spring semester with a student, but what we think is happening is fox are coming closer to humans to gain refuge or seek refuge from coyotes because coyotes won't come that close. And so fox are living closer to the human houses and things like that as a way to protect themselves from coyotes.
And frankly, there was a fox on Bascom Hill couple of weeks back? Or
yeah,
a few
I mean,
weeks
there's
back?
Been fox in Madison for years and yeah. years and years. But when you get one in a locale that is easily observed by many people, it really and it's great because it raises awareness for wildlife yeah. and brings attention to their you know needs and habitats and a lot of curiosity. And it was great. It was good press. But yeah, there's been a fox or two hanging around campus, which has been fun.
And Carol,
was he
just
looking for food from me or what? Was
no,
it, why would he chase me? I mean,
they're just curious animals, and they're seeing what's going on. And so, what I just to finish this call out, what I would encourage you to do is if what you did was not enough to scare the fox away, continue to do that, but be more aggressive and maybe carry something you can throw at the animal. But try to instill some fear in it as much as you possibly can. And if the fox does become aggressive, then please do call your animal control officer in your area and or the police department and let them know, because they we don't want them attacking people because it's not safe for people. It's not also safe for the fox. So
no, for sure. Thank you very much, Carol, for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking today with David Drake and Jamie Nack, wildlife specialists in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Well, earlier we played a sound of an animal, and several people, Judith tells me, have emailed in or sent on Facebook the correct answer. We'll play it again. There we go. And, you know, Don and DePere said that's a Packer fan attending a game after a Chicago Bears score. But that is not the correct answer, is it? What is the correct answer?
No, that's a porcupine. And there was another clue within it. Yeah. You could hear it shake, and you could hear the quills on the back and along the tail as it shook. So maybe we can play a brief clip again but to hear that. But so porcupines are a pretty unique mammal. They're a member of the rodent family. They exist in northern and central Wisconsin and the forest. And pretty neat animal. They've got some formidable weaponry on their back.
Yep.
So not too many animals have been able to successfully take porcupines as prey items. But fisher, in fact, which have been reintroduced in the state, are pretty good at...
they know how to tip them over.
They know how to flip them on their bellies and get to them. So anyway, porcupines are pretty unique animal. Fun to see. And they... There's that shake.
Yep.
Kind of another interesting thing about porcupines is they have an affinity for salt in their diet. So mm-hmm. They're active mostly at night, and oftentimes you see them as a common roadkill in the northern part of the state, and they're often getting salt off of roads. And they can cause some damage to buildings and cabins, or even if you leave a hammer out on the landscape.
Or plywood.
Yep. But
I
your
have
perspiration.
Some experience with
yeah.
plywood.
So they are a member of the rodent family, and anyway, pretty unique yeah. animal in and of itself.
Yeah, and they make one other sound. So that sound we just heard is more the mother calling to the young and stay in contact with each other. But they also make a very high-pitched, squealing, kind of screaming sound sometimes when they're mating. And I will let everybody on the air or listening insert their own joke with that. But those are the two primary sounds they make, is the high pitch and then that kind of murmur that you just heard.
Jim in Winnebago County is up next. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, folks. I have a question that's the greatest mystery of the universe. It has to do with rough grouse cyclic population. And as I understand it, the current working hypothesis is that, at least in part, the population dives periodically due to migration down from Canada of goshawks who are seeking additional prey as the hare population in Ontario is reduced and they need to actually move on and find something else to eat. I'd like to know if that is still the working hypothesis on the grouse cycle, and if so, does the population in Ontario follow the same cycle as it does in Wisconsin? That is, if the goshawks are moving south, does the population remain steady in Ontario?
Well, Jim, that's a really great question, and I wish Gary Zimmer from the Rough Grouse Society was sitting right here to fill in some of the details, but I believe you're right in that it is still a working hypothesis. We still, even though rough grouse and their 10-year cycle has been studied for decades, we still don't have a confirmation or exact result or idea of that relationship. But you are right in that there are a number of players involved in terms of the grouse, their predator, the goshawk, and the alternate prey for the goshawks certainly in Canada with the snowshoe hares. So certainly all of them are involved. As far as goshawk populations, whether they track similarly in Canada and Wisconsin, I really am not sure, David. I don't know.
Well, we have goshawks that stay here year round,
right?
Up in especially the northern part of the state is their primary range here. So. Yeah, and I'm not sure about that. I do recall reading, and unfortunately I don't remember all the details in this, but I do recall reading recently that people who look at cyclical wildlife populations, that they're starting to question if those are true cycles or not. And so what we've always considered a 10-year cycle for rough grouse may be something other than just cycling. It might be something, other factors. And as both you and Jamie have already mentioned, it is a working hypothesis.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And there is a lot of literature on it. I'm sure you've looked at some of that, Jim. And typically in Wisconsin, it's our years that end in 9 or 0 that tend to be the peak of our rough grouse cycle. So right now, if you're interested in kind of where we're at, we're kind of on the downward trend, and hopefully we'll be rebuilding those populations again. So.
Yeah.
Right. One of the things I was asking about is, does the grouse population in Ontario, particularly northern Ontario, cycle as it does in Wisconsin?
I'm sure it probably does, because that's kind of been what's prescribed for grouse populations, throughout their range in general. So I'm sure it does. It may not cycle on that same, for example, as Jamie said, the high years here in Wisconsin are ending in 9 and 0. It may not be the same high years as in Ontario, but they probably do fluctuate up and down over the course of a decade.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Is there any bird that tastes better than a grouse? I'm telling you,
they are pretty good table fare.
Oh my goodness!
And then the counterpart, those, the woodcock. Some people love those, but other people say they taste like worms.
The key with woodcock is bacon. Wrap them in bacon, marinate them, and put them on the grill. They make a pretty nice appetizer.
Don and Muscadet, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Yes. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
My sister actually and stuff is who I'm calling for. Aren't bluebirds supposed to migrate?
Yes, Dawn, they are supposed to migrate. And I see on your call that apparently your sister is still seeing some bluebirds around, and that very well could be the case. And the reason they migrate out of our area is because bluebirds are primarily insectivores, so they eat almost solely insects. And obviously, insects aren't here in the wintertime. But I've had calls in the last couple of years saying that people have seen bluebirds well into December before. And it is a little unusual that they're here. But sometimes, even though we've got cold temperatures and snow on the ground, that we still occasionally can get insect hatches. And so if you are, fly fish, for example, sometimes you can be out on a cold winter day. But if you have a nice warm sun, that you'll get an insect hatch. And so if the bluebirds are sticking around someplace where insects are, that they probably can get enough food. They might be eating some alternative food sources as well. And eventually they're going to have to move out of here or they're going to perish.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of what I thought. She's got, it's like a trio of them. And they always come to this one house they have for years, the nest. And they're living in that house. And, well, the other house they put up for bluebirds is it got a chickadee that stays right now. But that's, we were kind of, I told her, I said, I'm kind of worried about them because, I can't believe that they're still here.
If you wanted, and I guess I hesitate a little bit to offer this suggestion, but if you want to try to help them, one thing you might try to do is put out some mealworms. And you can get mealworms from pet stores usually, and you can just put them out in a tray or a kind of platform feeder. The reason I hesitate to mention that is the mealworms, they may come to them, and it might boost their energy for them to get the heck out of here. But it, since there's a food source you provide, and they also may try to stay here through the winter, and that's not necessarily what we want.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, that's kind of what we were wondering, you know, if...
The goldenrod grubs from a fishing...
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
That's another, if you can go to a fishing, a bait store. But David makes a good point. You know, you don't want them to, they shouldn't stay all winter.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it would be nice if they could get a little boost to get
that. If your sister can catch the bird, have her drive it south.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Don.
Always helpful.
Yeah, great advice there. Great advice from David Drake. Jamie Knack is shaking her head saying, what the heck? David and Jamie are with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the University of Wisconsin, Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have them with us. Thank you so much for tuning in as we talk with them about, well, lots of things relating to wildlife here in Wisconsin, including gifts. And, you know, we were talking about, we mentioned near the start of the program, we talked about some gifts. And now just recently here with bird bath mentioned, I thought, oh, you know what? There's another gift.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the... So if you enjoy feeding wildlife or you have somebody in the family that you're buying gifts for, there's all sorts of things associated with feeding birds, wildlife, or artificial nesting structures and things like that. So whether it's a bird feeder and maybe you splurge and you get them a squirrel-proof bird feeder that works mm-hmm. off of a counterweight.
Mm-hmm.
Or a heated bird bath so they can enjoy bird watching throughout the winter. There are other squirrel-proof feeders that you can buy as well. You could buy them bird seed or even give them a gift certificate to a nice...
I do that every year to some relatives.
And it's really nice. I mean, that's a really nice gift. Bird seed is not cheap.
No.
So that's a good one. And then as far as like some of the artificial... bird houses. I mean, you can buy unique style bird houses in different shapes. I've seen one that's a Stormy Cromer hat. Actually, Scott has one of those at the cabin. Yeah. And there's other ones, whether it's a Packer or a Badger one. You can find things for the sports enthusiasts. But also a bat house would be another nice gift.
Absolutely. And wildlife guides are kind of nice, too. The ID guides, bird IDs and other animal IDs.
Yep, they're wonderful. Not only are they wonderful as a book, but nowadays there are so many options for applications or apps on your smartphone devices that you can actually download the entire bird ID guide or a mammal ID guide with everything you'd find in the book. It can come onto your phone, and you have the sound capabilities. You can actually, if we play What's a Porcupine Sound Like, we can actually, you know, play that off of our phone. So in some of those apps, there is a fee for, some are free, but for some of the more advanced ones, you do have to pay for that.
Yeah, but $15, $20 is kind of know, where they top out.
The maximum,
they really are some nice ones because you do have the audio right with
it. Yeah, and it's nice to have that. You know, I've got my phone in my pocket all the time. It's nice to have that with you at all times. And the one thing maybe we should mention quickly is about bird feeding is certainly feeding wildlife is a wonderful thing to do, but make sure that you keep your bird feeders clean, and especially as you get into the warmer months, which we don't have to worry about too much right now. But the other issue is bird feeding is usually exempt from baiting regulations, but do keep in mind that in the southern part of the state and other parts of the state now that CWD is being found, that you have to pay attention to baiting regulations, and so you're not getting yourself in trouble, and you're also not harming wildlife.
You know, the counterweight ones, I have two of the, they're kind of expensive.
They are, but they're usually made out of metal, right?
Yep, made out of metal. They're going to last forever. Although, I took mine apart just to clean, they were getting a little sticky.
Yep.
And I took them apart to clean them, and I was amazed at how much gunky stuff, frankly, was in there.
It does. You get a little bit of moisture, and those seeds stick into the corners, and you need a toothpick and a toothbrush to scour all those little crevices.
I was able to do it in the fall while the weather was still nice, but I was surprised that I thought... They looked pretty clean on the outside, but, you know, once you take them apart, it's good to get those clean.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Jerry in Portage, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning, Larry, and I appreciate your guests kind of already answering most of my questions.
Oh.
I have been in my house for about 41 years and never, ever seen a bluebird. In the last 3 weeks, they have been daily visitors, but they never touch the bird seed. They always just sit at my heated water bath and just drink and drink and drink like they have been looking for water all day. I listening to your guests, I suspect I should just leave them alone, and hopefully by the next snowfall they will have gotten the hint and move on south. But I will not change my seed then to attract them, but I'll sure keep the water out there for them. They just seem like they've just
That's a great
enjoying
thing.
The heck out of that heated water.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, Jerry, the bird seed's not going to help the bluebird, so don't change the seed. You're still going to attract the birds that will eat seed. They just simply don't eat bird seed. But it's really interesting. You know, animals need food, water, shelter. And as far as water goes, oftentimes that's the limiting factor, that if whether it's in the summer and you put out a bird bath or you have a little landscaping pond, water can often be that added addition to your landscaping that brings in a lot more water or a lot more wildlife, whether that's because there's insects associated with the water in the summer that they're feeding off of, or providing water during these cold temperatures when their other sources are frozen. So, yeah, keep it up. That's wonderful to be able to see a new species for you.
And like you say, that is a great gift for someone. We don't always think about how badly the birds need water in the wintertime, but those little heated water baths are sure come. Sure, attract them.
Yeah. Thank you again for calling. There aren't any solar ones, are there? Are there ones that don't rely on? Be great if you could have
you didn't
one
have
that
to
didn't,
plug it in.
If you didn't have to plug it in.
Everyone I've seen still has, you know, some sort of heated element. But I would guess you could. I mean, you can. I was just thinking about this because we have a puppy that's outside and we have a heated dog bowl.
Mm-hmm.
It could be something. I mean, you could look for something like that, too, but it has to be something heated. And, I don't know of any solar.
I don't either, but I bet you if you're pretty handy, or probably just relatively handy, it can't be too hard to affix a solar panel and get rid of the plug.
Judith just says they exist, but they are pretty pricey now. $75 to $150.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which that's pretty pricey.
Yeah.
Well, there's another gift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
There's another gift and no electricity bill and maybe it'll pay for itself in the long term. Who knows?
Well, I will actually take a look at that. That might be a family Christmas present of, one for the whole family.
Yep.
We'll think about that. Tom in Green Bay. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I have some comments about your goshawk ruffed grouse question. Your Canadian birds are really obligates to snowshoe hare and ruffed grouse. There's not much up there else for them to eat in the taiga. In Wisconsin, there's a much greater diversity of prey items, and although our Wisconsin goshawks are cyclic, they don't exhibit what happens in Canada. And when we go up and down, our goshawk population may fluctuate by perhaps 40%, whereas in Canadian populations, they may fluctuate by 90%, and the birds entirely move out. If you take a look at the historical data, goshawk invasions have occurred when there's a peak in Wisconsin. In other words, there's been a crash in Canada, and they hit Wisconsin, and the migrant goshawks coming in will stay and feed and then return to Canada. We've had other cycles. That was like in 72, in 82, when the goshawks came through, our grouse population had already crashed. So it had very little impact on our Wisconsin grouse. And you're talking when these populations move in Canada, much like the snowy owls, you don't know exactly where they came from. It could be eastern Canada, it could be Ontario, Manitoba, could be far western Canada. And so they're random when the birds pick up. What kind of weather pattern they get stuck in is where they end up. And there's quite a difference in the patterns from marked birds where they ended up and also the fact that they returned to Canada. And so there's a lot to the 10-year cycle. If you want to read a good book, I would suggest you look for one in your library that came out of the University of Wisconsin Press by Lloyd Keith. called Wildlife's 10-Year Cycle.
Lloyd Keith,
he was a professor down there, and he's got a whole host of papers that were published on the cycle in the Canadian Field Naturalist and a lot of other places.
Yeah, Lloyd was actually a member of your department, he not?
Yep, he sure was. The other person who was a big grouse researcher was Gordon Gillian over in Minnesota.
He also documented the same thing. In fact, his cycle, he looked at the changes in aspen and the fact that aspen went through cycles. Well, what happens with the snowshoe hare, they feed on the vegetation. The vegetation gets browsed down to the point where rather than producing proteins, they start producing things which are not attractive or taste very good and don't do anything for snowshoe hare. And that's probably the peak. That's when the cycle drops and they start going down. In aspen, Gillian published things on the fact that different clones of aspen had more protein when they were budding in the fall, the grouse were, and that these things were also cyclic from over-browsing by the grouse. Hmm. So there's also a plant-animal relationship here besides animal-animal. The cycles, you can go through the Hudson Bay Company's data, and you can see this 10-year cycle going all the way back to the early 1700s when they first started sending things back to England. And it's with lynx and fox and everything else. That's when we see the white horned owls that were first documented from Wisconsin by Hoy down in Racine back in the 1800s. Arcticus, now it's got a different name, but this is the real pale white horned owl that comes down from the tag. All of these things are cyclic with the snowshoe hare and the grouse and up there. When there's a cycle, and we haven't had a cycle now. I mean, the rough
grouse has been
up and down for 20 years, and we haven't had a flight since probably 92 was the last one, and that was just marginal into Wisconsin.
Very cool. Great information. Tom, I want to thank you so much. We could talk some more about this. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Many of us who live in Wisconsin count our amazing wildlife as one of our great treasures. And whether you're new to wildlife watching or you've been doing it all your life, it's great to have people around who know and care about our environment and who are knowledgeable about it and can talk with us about it. And we have two of those people here. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Jamie Knack, Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. One of our guests. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Larry.
Nice to have you with us. And David Drake, Wildlife Specialist with UW Extension. He's also a professor of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. David, thanks again for coming by today.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it very much. We have callers online, but still a couple of open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question or a wildlife experience to share, you can go that way. Or if you have a photo that you want and a question that you want to show us, go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to have you post some photos. We've had some great ones up, and I'm sure there'll be some more over the rest of the show. Rich and Barron has a question for you guys. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I was wondering, what's the difference between a raven and a crow, and do we have any ravens in Wisconsin?
Well, you have lots of ravens in Barron, the Barron area, I'm pretty sure.
Yep. Yeah, we sure do. So Rich, that's a good question. Both of those birds are large, relatively large birds. They're all solidly black. The difference is that the raven is larger than the crow, and ravens typically are found more in northern Wisconsin than they are in the southern two-thirds of Wisconsin. So whereas crows crows can be statewide. But the other thing with ravens is they have, it looks like their bill kind of got broken. They got a little bit of a hump on their top bill, whereas the crow, the bill is more of a straight line bill, if that makes sense. And then the other thing is their call. So we only have American crows here in Wisconsin, and they call, their call is caw, caw, caw. And then a raven's caw is more like a cronk, cronk. And so that's how you would differentiate the two from their call. But ravens are, even though they're all black, just like the crow is, if you look at their bill and look at the size of them and also where you are in the state, that will help you differentiate a raven versus a crow.
And I love the sound a raven makes.
They do have a pretty neat.
It's almost like a prehistoric kind of, to me, sound.
It's ruckus, yeah.
And it's fun to be sitting in the Shawamigan National Forest or someplace and have one of those fly over and call out.
Yep. And both of those, I should say, both of those species are relatively intelligent birds.
Oh, yeah. I saw on Facebook movie, a little video that somebody shot with their phone of a crow that had some sort of a little pan or a piece of tin, and it had the tin in its mouth. It would go to the top of the roof of the snow-covered roof and jump on and slide down the side of the and then pick it up and take it back up to the top and slide back down and did it like several times in a row.
Yeah.
It was just sledding.
Yeah, they are a smart bird, and they're actually one of the few bird species that actually can use tools. So they'll use sticks to get things out of crevices and other types of implements or tools like that.
That was a very, very cool shot. Rich, thank you for calling. And we have Linda says a screech owl kicked the sparrows out of the birdhouse hanging off her garage roof and is now fighting with the squirrels for possession. So that's kind of a cool wildlife observation on Facebook from Linda.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And of course, those owls are getting close to their breeding and nesting season as well. They nest early.
Yeah, and Andy in Madison wondered if he saw a pair of owls. He didn't get close enough to really, you know, see them. Wondered if they might be snowy owls, but... Well, we're getting into the breeding season for...
We are. And I guess, Andy, one thing I would offer is if they were snowy owls, they're probably going to be moving. In other words, they're not going to stay in the area for long. If it was perhaps the more common barred or great horned owls, the likelihood of you seeing them again are probably pretty good. So just be on the lookout, and maybe you'll get another chance at identifying those owls.
And I would say statistical chance, you've got a better chance of seeing this from the size of your description, Andy. You've got a better chance of those being great horned or barred owls versus snowy owls.
Yeah, probably. But cool, nevertheless. I mean, just to see owls in the wild to me is always cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dave in Fort Atkinson. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
I love your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, two things. One day last fall, I was out walking the wildlife area, and I saw a red-tailed hawk come down, and he picked up a snake. And that snake had to be about 4 feet long. It was the funniest thing I ever seen. This hawk was doing everything he could to stay aloft. I couldn't believe he was that hungry.
They will commonly take snakes. Red-tailed hawks will take a variety of prey, snakes being one of them. And I imagine that was quite a sight, seeing it rustling that snake in the air.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that snake wrapped around him, and he had all he could do to stay aloft.
Yep.
The other question I have, I have a lot of dogs here, so I always have leftover crumbs of dog food and whatever. So I thought, why throw it away? So I took it out and threw it in a bird feeder and on the ground. And I couldn't believe how many birds came in to eat this stuff. Is that good for them or no?
Well, it's kind of a tough question. One, it probably depends a little bit on the quality of the dog food. Obviously, the more money you spend, the higher quality, the higher protein value within dog food. The cheapest dog food you find has a lot of fillers. So, I mean, there's some logic in the type of dog food you choose. So that being said, if it's a high quality dog food, you know, potentially, of course, bird seed and products that are made specifically for birds are probably better choices. But we often have people that are talking about feeding bread or whole corn to ducks and things like that. And again, that's not really what's on their menu in the natural world. It's probably not the best choice. So whether it's harmful, I'm not sure. But, you know, selecting bird seeds that are specific for wildlife would probably be a better choice.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Dave, for calling. Appreciate it. And we have a recommendation for... an app for apps. Facebook comment from Lori. A couple of great birding apps I just purchased one is Larkwire, which is an excellent birdsong quiz app, and Count Circle, a map app that includes all Audubon Christmas bird count circles. And I guess correctly, I guess correctly on the porcupine.
Yeah.
So there's so Larkwire and Count Circle.
Well, I'll have to look into those. I imagine there are more apps coming out as we speak. I mean, just constantly evolving. The one that I've purchased is the iBird Pro, and I just really like it. It's a, you know, a field guide. It's easy to search. There's just so many different ways to search with an app than there are with a field guide in hand.
And Steve has a question I think may relate to that from Kendall. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
You touched earlier on apps and whatnot, and now again, at one point last summer, I was with a nephew up north near Star Lake. He was demonstrating on a tablet, you know, an app with bird calls, because we were seeing an eagle at the time, and I was amazed at the accuracy that, you know, that even these little tablets produce. And the eagle nearby, I mean, was obviously pretty agitated when it heard it, and I'm wondering if, you know, if people just need to be cautioned about how they use some of the apps, if it can be detrimental to wildlife and birds.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's a really great point, and it's something we intended to say earlier. So especially during the breeding season, so you're correct. Some birders may see this as a great tool while they're in the field. They hear a bird song. They can't identify it. They go to the apps and start playing songs and try to weed through which one they just heard. It can stress birds out. Males singing on territories, they see it as a competing male. They're trying to look for it. Certainly can disorient females. So the etiquette that birders should use is that is a tool. It is a resource, but it should be used within, you know, a vehicle or back in the office or your home. It shouldn't be used in the field to make those identifications. So, you know, try to mentally file what that sound sounded like, or make a note in a journal, and then go back to a vehicle where the sound can be contained, or turn it way down so that you aren't stressing out the birds. But absolutely, it can be detrimental. So mm-hmm.
There you go.
And there are birding ethics, believe it
yes.
or not. And so if you want to Google birding ethics, one of the things on some of the ethics is not pishing, which you go psh, 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 to attract birds, especially the flocking species. And also some of the calls. And when we did the Wisconsin Birdathon last spring, that using artificial calls was illegal.
Yep. So many of the competitions, the friendly birding competitions that go on, those are laid out as not legal means of attracting and seeing birds. So
there you go. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. And I'm going to go back to gifts and activities for just a minute, because we're just about through our list of one of the things. There's so many great wildlife books out there for children, Jamie, that I think it's worth mentioning.
Yeah, and not to necessarily name specific books, but, I mean, just doing a search on Amazon or other, going into Borders or Barnes & Noble and looking in the wildlife section, there's lots of great books for kids. I mean, whether it's species-specific, you're interested in bluebirds. I'm watching my daughter, you know, she's obviously being brainwashed into wildlife. So every Monday they get to go to the library and pick out a book. And she always brings home some kind of wildlife book, whether it's butterflies or the one this week is on raccoons. So anyway, there are a lot of books out there. So you can definitely play to your child or your grandchildren's interest in specific animals or wildlife in general.
So one thing we haven't talked too much about are memberships. And so there's a lot of what are called non-government organizations or conservation organizations out there that really rely on membership sponsorship. And so it's when you buy a membership to that organization, so some would be the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, for example, or Audubon Society, or National Wildlife Turkey Federation, or Quality Deer Management, or, you know, Whitetails Unlimited, Pheasants Forever. So there's a bunch of those conservation organizations you might want to consider buying somebody a membership, annual membership for a present. And then one thing we haven't talked too much about is trail cameras or those game cameras. And
the price is going up. So if you're looking for a more expensive gift.
Yeah, and those are, you know, anywhere from $200 to over $1,000, depending on what kind of game camera you get and what kind of whiz-bang things you get on the camera. But those game cameras are just a ton of fun. And certainly, you know, if you go to the DNR website, Wisconsin DNR website, they've got a page dedicated where you can upload your photos off your game camera. And it is just a really, really fun thing to do. And it's a family activity, especially if you've got kids or family or you've got some land you want to see what's out there. Those game cameras are just awesome. And now they've got cameras that you can also put in lakes for fish cameras. So you can adhere to your dock leg and see what, you know, the big pike swimming by and what time you need to drop your lure in the water.
Great ideas. I know Pat Durkin had in the Wisconsin State Journal a couple weeks back had some great suggestions, and he had one trail camera that actually wasn't too bad in price range that he liked a lot.
Yeah, they can go anywhere from, I bet you now you could get them on a good sale, anywhere from $60 to hundreds of dollars, $300-$400, yeah. And some of those will take video and they'll take color photos. So
winter is a great time to enjoy our state parks and park areas as well. And there are, on New Year's Day, there are a whole bunch of the state park program's got a whole bunch of events going on at Devil's Lake and High Cliff and Kettle Moraine, Mirror Lake. And these are a whole variety of events involving hiking or skiing. And
yeah, I think if you watch now, come later window when the snow conditions are a bit better throughout the state, you'll also see candlelight hikes that include skiing as well. So
and snowshoeing.
And yeah. Snowshoeing, yeah.
That's right.
And I would go to the, you can go to the website, the state parks, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website. Look that up because there are, and I think we probably have it posted on my Facebook page. Judith will put it up in the next few minutes because there's a whole bunch of great events going on New Year's Day and, of course, a lot of other days as well.
Yeah, and kids are off of school and there's that, long stretch of break. You're looking for activities.
And winter is just an awesome time to be out, obviously, because you get to do some activities you don't get to do any other time of the year. But you've got all the snow on the ground, and that is a wonderful tracking medium. So you get a chance to see tracks in the snow from a variety of animals that you normally would never get to see any other time of the year. And so, certainly the DNR takes advantage of that. They'll do tracking surveys with wolves and teach you how to do that if you wish to do that. But just if you're out and about, bring a tracking book with you, and you never know what you're going to run across.
Sarah in Zion, Illinois, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hey, Larry. I live down here just west of Illinois Beach State Park, which has a lot of habitat, and I always get owls behind my building. I mean, not owls, hawks behind my building. But last week I saw two birds that were so much bigger than hawks. They were like twice the size of hawks. And I thought if it had had a white head, I mean, obviously it would have been an eagle, but it didn't. Couldn't these have been immature, or could they have been immature birds just wandering down here?
Yep. They, if you're talking about the size and they looked like a raptor, it probably was an eagle. And as a matter of fact, I just saw a bald eagle over by where I live yesterday. And we live kind of in southern Wisconsin. So it could be bald eagles for sure, and it could be an immature bald eagle. And obviously those immatures don't have the white head and the white tail, depending on their age at that time you see them. So if they were immature bald eagles, what you would look for is actually a white armpit. So they would be kind of a blackish, brownish mottled bird, large. Bald eagles, when they fly, it looks like they've got two big planks for wings. If they're soaring, their wings are pretty straight, and they're not dihedral like a turkey vulture would be. And so if it's immature, you would look for those white armpits as they're soaring. But the other bird that might be out there is a turkey vulture. And so turkey vultures are another large black bird. They have no feathering on the head, so that if you look through a pair of binoculars, they'd have a kind of a reddish-skinned head. But unlike bald eagles, when turkey vultures soar, they hold their wings. It was what's called a dihedral V, so it's kind of a V-shaped wing as they're soaring around. So, and the other thing you'd look for on the turkey vulture is at the end of each wing, they have almost looks like feathered fingers. So they've got individual feathers off the end of the wing. So those are the two birds you might want to look at. Look up on again in a bird book or on a search image on your computer.
Sarah,
I can tell you, I've seen turkey vultures, and it did not have
they
wings
didn't have
like
that shape.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just through Rockford a couple days ago and saw two or three bald eagles on my trip. So they were in the area.
Wow.
Yeah, they're there. They're there, Sarah.
They are.
Quick woodpecker question real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, at my bird feeder, which is just a pot, it's an old pot that has like a lot of dirt in it, and I just dump bird seeds on top of it. So it started after it snowed the other day. I've had a woodpecker there like all day long, every day. And are they eating seeds or is he trying to peck out the dirt?
Do you know which one? What's the headline?
Redheaded.
It very well might be a northern flicker, or it's also called a yellow-shafted flicker. And what might be happening is those pots you're dumping out, if the soil's not frozen, you may have some insects in that soil. But flickers, about half of their diet is made up of ants. And so of all the woodpecker species we have in our both Wisconsin and Illinois, similar woodpecker species for the most part, but flickers of all the woodpecker species spend a considerable amount of time on the ground in people's lawns because they're pecking for ants. And so, again, if you've got a bird book, look up northern flicker and see if that's the bird you saw.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Speaking of bird sightings, email from Barbara, who says, I'm in the Avoca area, not far from Muscogee, and I see bluebirds every month of the year. I've been seeing more red-headed woodpeckers as well. Red-headed woodpeckers are rare. I haven't seen one in a while.
You know, they're making a comeback.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of effort to do restoration work for them. My parents had one at the house last time I was home visiting, so it was really a treat to see it.
Oh, absolutely. And she's seeing some bald eagles in the Clyde area as well.
Yep.
Jack in Madison, what are you seeing these days?
Thank you for this wonderful program. We have a bird bath in the backyard and a heater in it, so we have a lot of birds. But yesterday I saw something I've never seen before. We have a deck that's out in the sun, and I looked out the window and there were six mourning doves, and they stayed there all afternoon until the sun left. Do you think they're on the way somewhere else or from the neighborhood? I never saw that many together, and I've never seen them in our backyard like that.
But Jack, mourning doves are a state species here. They're native to Wisconsin, and they're a year-round species. So they'll be here year-round, and they probably found something they liked in your deck, either water or the sunshine or whatever the case is. And a lot of times if you look up on wires, you know, telephone wires, you'll see them perching up there. They're kind of obviously, as you noticed yesterday, they're a bit of a rotundish bird, and they've got this long, pointy tail when they're perched. And then when they fly, especially when they first start flying from a perch position, they kind of squeak. Their wings squeak because they're squeezing air between their wing and their body, and that's what creates that squeaking noise. But they're a very, very common bird, and sometimes you can find them in rather large flocks.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Here's a really nice comment that I wanted to share, a Facebook comment from Vicky, who said, I was on my way to visit my grandpa in the nursing home, and our program provided her with an invaluable topic of conversation.
Well, thanks, Vicky. It's nice to see so many people enjoying wildlife, and I think it's a topic that's easily enjoyed by many, many people. So thank you.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. Jim in Colfax wondered if a bird of prey could pick up a house cat.
Well, Jim, I would say it depends on the size of the house cat. Some of these tabbies I've seen that weigh 30 pounds, probably not going to happen. But a red-tailed hawk, a great horned owl, it's possible certainly they could kill the cat. But
apparently there were some talon marks on the tree.
Yeah,
yep.
It would be probably pretty difficult for them to lift that animal off the ground. I know red-tailed hawks will commonly take rabbits, but as far as being able to fly off with a rabbit, that gets to be difficult. So a lot of times they'll eat it right there on the spot. Same for a pheasant or something like that. So if it was a smaller cat, it's possible in short distances it's able to move it or drag it.
But I will say, I think I've told the story in the past on the radio show, but in New York City, they'll use birds of prey to control rats and pigeons, yeah. And a red-tailed hawk has picked up a hairless chihuahua once in one of the New York City parks, so it is possible.
Yeah. On that note, Happy New Year. Merry Christmas to you guys. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll see you in 2014.
Sounds good.
David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests with UW Extension, the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.